Looking for a graduation gift to inform, inspire, and encourage? When you give a subscription to Christianity Today, you're giving redemptive, relevant news and thoughtful, balanced dialogue about the church, current issues, and public theology. Visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to get a discounted student subscription for the graduates in your life. Starting at only $2 per month, this gift will engage and grow their faith throughout the year. Click the link in the show notes or visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to order now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, this is Russell Moore. You're listening to The Russell Moore Show. Every week, we come together for questions and conversations, and this is one of the questions weeks where I take the questions that you all have sent. And before we start doing that, if you have a question about anything, big or small, send it to questions@russellmoore.com, and I'll do my best to answer it. We won't use your name on the air unless you ask us to, so we're not going to embarrass you. But send those to questions@russellmoore.com. And I'm joined by our producer, Ashley Hales. Ashley, welcome.
Thanks. It's so fun to be here.
What kinds of questions do we have this week?
Well, I thought we'd start off with something a little fun. Christmas is on its way. So I would love to hear, what is your favorite Christmas present that you received as a child?
Ha. My favorite Christmas present as a child, probably when I was 11 and my parents got me a bookcase.
Nice.
to put books on. I think that has to be probably my favorite.
And that would make a lot of sense looking just behind you, right?
Yeah. But I also think I was always more excited by the stockings than I was by the presents.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, there's just something about, you know, the surprise of going through that stocking and finding stuff in it.
Yes. That is so fun. That's great. Well, as we think about some of these fun issues, of course, but we also have a whole lot of serious questions from our listeners. And let's start off with the idea of social media. So Twitter, as we know, seems to have been in a sort of dumpster fire recently, but this brings up larger questions about...
By recently, you mean the last decade, then yes.
Well, that is true, but, you know, it's blown up even further, I suppose, unsurprisingly. But, you know, as we think about the issue of social media, one of your listeners wants to ask this question. Do you think that social media narratives are an issue of human dignity? So do they merit a stiffer theological warning for us as we participate in these sorts of forums? What do you think about that? How do we think about social media in terms of discipleship?
Well, I'm wondering what the listener means by a theological warning, because it could mean a couple things. I mean, one of those things could mean a warning as in, don't use social media at all. And I think in that sense, there's really no way to get away from social media, even if you're not using it, because of the way that social media just changes the whole environment around us and changes the way that people act in real life. I mean, you can just even see with the way that social media platforms have evolved and changed over time. And Facebook starts out as kind of college kids connecting with each other. And now we come to a place where it's a lot of baby boomers doing politics and conspiracy theories and arguing with each other. Twitter started out. I remember Twitter was really fun at the very beginning. And I had, you know, most of the people at that time were people who followed me. I mean, who kind of knew me in some way or the other. And so the people who followed me were those folks. So I could kind of make jokes or have some sarcasm and people would get it.
Right.
And I noticed the change when my friend David Platt, who wrote a book called Radical about getting away from the American dream, he was in town and we were riding around somewhere and I said, I'm here in David's new Bentley, joking.
Right.
And so all of these people, I think it's terrible that the author of Radical is buying a Bentley and whatever.
Yeah.
Like, this has changed here because people would have known that ahead of time. All those things, they shift and they change. And I wouldn't say the warning is necessarily don't get involved in those things and don't participate in them.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, I would. What I would say is, be aware of what these things do to people generally, and then be aware of what they do to you. So you may notice, for instance, that Twitter is making you into a combative, if Twitter exists by the time that we have this Twitter or whatever comes after.
Right.
It turns you into a combative, sort of angry person. And if you are a combative, angry person, that is not a social media platform that you should be on at all.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you're somebody who has body image issues, or envy, sorts of your weak point is envy and covetousness. Instagram's probably not the place for you. So I think just constantly kind of having an internal check-in. But I don't, and I also think the theological warning would be remembering what Jesus says about the integrity of the inside and the outside, of the reality and the image. And sometimes what social media can do is to cause you to split those apart, where you're putting one image out on social media, but it doesn't really match the reality. And so I would just watch that and ask myself that question every once in a while.
Yeah. And how might you see the church speaking into that issue particularly?
Well, I think that one thing that that should happen is in our teaching, mentoring, discipleship, asking the question, what is social media doing to you right now? What do you notice in your life in terms of social media? Because, I mean, I have a lot of, it seems as though social media is among the number one, two or three questions that pastors have for me or problems that they have, because a lot of times pastors will say, I look out on my members' Facebook feeds, usually is what they're bringing up. But they bring up Facebook. And as I look at that and I just think, what have I been doing that this is the end product of the discipleship? And I just always have to say, this is not your fault. And what you're seeing, you can't resolve that with a 2-week sermon series on how to responsibly use social media. I mean, this is coming from 10 years ago. It's light from distant stars showing up now. But what you can do is to shape and prepare people for whatever the next wave of the metaverse or whatever it is that we have, so that they're at least at the beginning starting to not unintentionally get swept into something that's going to change them. But just asking that question periodically, I think, is the main thing. And the other thing would be, don't allow your children to go onto social media platforms early or in adolescence. I mean, you can look at all of the studies. Social media has a negative influence, dramatically negative, on teenage mental health, on anxiety, on depression, on all of those things. And it's not, I mean, adolescence is hard enough when you're kind of looking around and saying, what does everyone think of me? But when you add 24 hours a day, a judgment seat of people who are who are evaluating you, or you're looking and you're seeing it, these are the things I wasn't invited to. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a heavy, heavy burden for kids. And so you'll get some complaints from adolescents. Hold the line.
Yeah.
And just say no.
Yeah. Can I ask how you did? I mean, you have some teenagers in the house. What does that look like for you, you know, in your community? I'm asking also as a mother of teens.
Yeah. Well, we don't allow them to, what we do is we have parental controls that only have specific apps that are allowed to be used. So not social media platforms at all. Other than, I mean, if you consider YouTube a social media site, which in some ways it is, they can have that, but it's limited in terms of what they can see and how much time they can spend on it in any given day.
Yeah.
And so you make those restrictions. You know, when we, early on, when we, you know, everybody in our neighborhood, the kids at 9, 10 years old were getting iPhones and our kids were not. And one of my kids said, why can't we? And I said, well, here's why. This is what I'm concerned about for you, and this is what we're trying to do. And so I have one kind of strong Enneagram 1 energy sort of kid. And he says to the neighbor kids, you know, it's just really terrible that your parents don't love you. And I said, I didn't say their parents didn't love them.
Right.
Everybody's trying to figure this out. But
that's good. That's good.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/RussellMoore.
We do need a community around us, though, to make some of these decisions. So I appreciate you bringing that up. You know, and as we, you know, think about social media, you know, everyone's exhausted, everyone's tired. Another listener asked the question, how do we not grow weary? You know, there's so much post-pandemic. What does Christian perseverance look like in this moment in time? And where can we go to be buoyed?
Well, you know, that listener, I am not that worried about. And here's why. Because he or she recognizes that they are weary and exhausted. The people I'm most worried about are the people who are bone dead exhausted and they don't know it. And so they're just continuing to run forward and kind of just numbing themselves in those places where they're exhausted. Sometimes they're numbing themselves literally with substances to kind of just shut down their minds. But many times it's not that. It's that they think I have to keep going in the way that I've been going and something is wrong, but they don't know what is wrong. Those are the people that I'm really concerned about. And what I would say about growing weary, I mean, the Bible tells us repeatedly, do not grow weary. For instance, do not grow weary in well-doing. Talks about the sagging shoulders and the droopy knees that can come in following Christ. That recognizes that there is weariness. I mean, the Bible's not speaking to things that that don't happen. And so there's that sense of that is going to be the case for you. And it's going to be the case for you probably more than you know. And so I think that some of the ways, I just look at Jesus, the way that Jesus is going forward, pulling back, going forward, mm-hmm. pulling back. He goes into the crowds, he goes into ministry, he's headed toward Jerusalem, and then he'll pull the disciples to the side, or he'll pull three of the disciples to the side, or sometimes he just goes by himself off somewhere. And I think that is really important. I think it's important that we can see that in the humanity of Jesus, but we also can see the fact that it was important enough that it was being referenced by the gospel writers under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit so many times. And so finding those ways to withdraw on a regular basis. So one kind of withdrawal once a day, one kind of withdrawal once a week. And then one kind of different sort of withdrawal at a different point in the year. I think that that's one of the ways. And then the other thing is to make sure that you maintain connections. I mean, I find that when I start getting truly weary, one of the things that I start doing is withdrawing in the wrong way.
Right.
So it's not that I'm kind of recharging. It's that I just kind of isolate and I don't really even notice that I'm not connecting with people. And so just having those, and I'll notice too, my wife mentions this a lot. There's a group of us friends. We do a book club together. And there are times when there's so much going on that I'll say, I'm not going to go tonight. And my wife will always say, oh, you will absolutely, every time that you make time for this, you come away saying, oh, I am so encouraged and revved up. And I'm so glad that I didn't not do that. Yeah. So sometimes just sort of force yourself. I'm going to call that friend, or I'm going to go to that. I'm going to go to that group of people getting together. I'm going to serve in that ministry at the church. And maintaining that sort of connection, I think is you can go too far.
Right.
And it can become even more tiring and wearying, but enough of that is energizing, I think.
You know, and it strikes me too, when you were talking about those spaces to pause, right? How that also fits with Andy Crouch's TechWise Family. And that kind of ties our conversation about social media in too, where he talks about making sure you don't have phones, you know, they're off for an hour during dinner. You take a digital Sabbath and you're taking a screen-free week. And those are the patterns, right? We see in scripture as well, those sorts of patterns of pausing and withdrawal that helps us to not go towards that numbness that you're talking about.
Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, if we're looking at social media, I know there was a time it seemed as though every time that our family went on vacation, Jerry Falwell Jr. would randomly attack me on Twitter. And so I would start getting people texting me, oh, can't believe that about Falwell again. I'm like, I don't. And Maria, my wife, started saying, I think that Jerry Falwell Jr. has like our calendar of vacations because it's every time. And so in the middle of one of those things, I was just, I don't really want to deal with it. I'm going to take a break from Twitter for a little while.
Yeah.
And I did. And I was intending it to be about a 2-week break, but it extended on into a month. And then it extended on into a year, to the point that this week, as we're recording this, I said, you know, I think I'm going to re-engage on Twitter. And it's right when the question becomes, is Twitter even going to continue to exist? So the timing's kind of perfect. But I found that for me, being off of that particular social media platform for a while was an answer to some exhaustion. But it also, I think I was I was disengaged with it for maybe too long that it was difficult for me to think about re-engaging.
Right. Right.
Sometimes that can be, I mean, sometimes that's a good thing. Sometimes you can say, okay, I don't need this. I'm not going to participate in it. Sometimes it's just, it's kind of a friend of mine who's a musician will talk about re-entry issues in his family. If he's been off on tour and he comes home, you can't just kind of immediately resume the way it was. And some of that's the case.
Yeah. You need some white space, right? To kind of to jump back in. Quickly, just a fun little aside, vacations, beach or mountains?
What I would say, the best vacation I've ever taken was both.
Oh.
On Oahu in Hawaii, the beaches, and then you drive through those amazing mountains. Mm-hmm. That was kind of perfect. I grew up on a beach, and a lot of people who grow up where I do, they go to the mountains just in the same way that people who grow up in the mountains go to the beach.
Yep.
But I like them both.
There you go.
I feel at home when I'm on a beach.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. That makes sense. Yeah, I grew up in Southern California, so definitely beach feels like home, but then we had lots of years in Salt Lake City, so I like them both too. I think that's the neither or both.
And I think we went, my dad was a guy of routine. Mm-hmm. And so we would go to the Smoky Mountains every summer for vacation and every year, never missed. We would stay in the exact same place. We would follow the exact same itinerary. Mm-hmm. If it's Tuesday, it's Cage Cove, and what have you. And I think I got a little burned out on that.
That makes sense.
Mix it up. Smoky Mountains are great, but I had a little too much of it.
Yes. I want to come back to the idea of numbness. You've written recently in one of your newsletters about this sense of numbness that we might be experiencing in the evangelical church. So rather than, as we're gearing up towards kind of we've just passed midterms and we're gearing up towards the election, presidential election here in America, there's a sense of which we might actually just kind of numb ourselves. Talk to us a little bit about what that looks like and what we might do to not numb ourselves to kind of the political polarization and rhetoric that has so angered American citizens?
Well, I think in this case, what I mean by numbness is not so much the exhaustion that we kind of shut down from, although there's a part of it in there. It's more what we have normalized and the way that we don't expect anything different. And so you look at, you can see this happen in a family or in a church where when people are in an unhealthy, toxic sort of environment, then what they start doing is comparing themselves to really, really extremely awful stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can always then seem as though things are in equilibrium. I think that's one of the issues with the church at Corinth. When the Apostle Paul is writing there, they have such a lowered expectation in many ways for what life in Christ ought to look like that they don't know what's normal anymore. And that's why he says, you've got a situation going on in your church that ought to shock you. It even shocks the unbelievers around you. And I think that's something of what has happened in American political life is that at the beginning of this era, And nobody has to agree with me on Trump. Everybody knows what I think about Donald Trump to the point that, I often joke that I'm glad that Maria and I didn't get married now because I'm afraid the vows would say, do you, Maria Hanna, take this man, longtime Trump critic, Russell Moore, to be your husband? Because it's just sort of, so everybody knows you don't have to agree with me on this. But you know what I think. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, one of the things that I would notice is that a lot of people, even people who supported him and disagreed with me on that were nonetheless shocked and rattled by behaviors and things that were done and stances that were taken. Now I think we're in a place where nothing even shocks us anymore. Mm-hmm. It's hard to even know now what's parody and what's reality. So there will be times when somebody will send me something off of social media, some sort of a statement by a politician in this kind of politics as circus sort of environment, say the shocking, outrageous things, and you don't even know whether it's, you have to look up whether it's parody or not. That's being replicated now in the church. So you can see, and I really worry particularly about young evangelical men, because I'm seeing this happen a lot, where you have guys who have a great deal of insecurities, and the way that they sort of make a name for themselves is by saying shocking, outrageous sorts of things, because then people will come in and denounce it and say, can you believe what John Smith said about, and that continues to feed their sense of self. That is real. We've sort of normalized that. 10 years ago, there would have been church meetings to say, you are in a really dangerous place and we're going to deal with it. Now, what happens is these guys find aging sort of Christian leaders who are afraid of them or who want to exploit them, who bring them into their circles to do this. And the end result is terrible for the church, and the end result is terrible for the souls of those people. And it's just, it doesn't surprise us anymore. And I think that's one of the reasons why when Donald Trump announced this week that he's running for president again this week as we're recording this, the response was not the kind of stress and division that we experienced the first couple of times around. Instead, it was sort of yawn. And that could be, in some cases, a sign of maturity and growth. In this case, I don't think it is. I think it's just that we have come to the point where we just said, well, this is what it is. And I noticed that a lot with teaching last year. I would have a lot of Christian students at University of Chicago who would come up and say, you know, I think that God's called me to public service, but almost none of them were planning for elective office. They were planning to be ambassadors or serving in agencies and entities of various kinds. But they said, I can't do what it takes to be elected now. And that's really a sign of something that's gone badly wrong.
Like when we can't imagine how we can contribute to the common good, you know, in official capacities because the official capacities have been co-opted, it makes it very hard to figure out how to lead.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m., we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
Help us understand, you know, given those realities, given the numbness, given, you know, the younger men who may be kind of quote unquote radicalized, what are leaders, pastors, more mature believers able to do?
Well, I think there are a couple things. I mean, one of those is to model something different. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know how important it was for me to be able to see particularly one pastor that I had as a kid who, when, you know, in every church, circuses start and things start to happen. And what I noticed was somebody who didn't lose his equilibrium. I mean, he wasn't panicked. He wasn't angry. He wasn't shocked. He wasn't cynical. He wasn't numb. He just kept doing what it is that God called him to do. And the model of that, I mean, I don't think that he in any way intentionally thought, oh, I'm giving an example for younger people. That's who he was spiritually, but it just had an unbelievable influence on me because of what you just said, the imagination of saying, okay, this is what a godly Christian looks like and what a godly Christian leader looks like. It was really, really important. And then the second thing is to have those sorts of people who are able to rebuke when the time comes, to come in and say, look at what the Bible says about quarrelsomeness. Yeah. I mean, the Bible is repeatedly throughout the New Testament talking about quarrelsomeness and unhealthy craving for controversy. And what do you do with a factious or an angry person? And so having those people who will say, no, I'm here in your life and I'm going to say to you, this is ungodly. We all need that in our lives, depending on what our specific points of vulnerability are. Mm-hmm. But that's really what we need.
Mm. Well, thank you for giving us some hope in the midst of what feels like a very tumultuous time. It's been such a pleasure to chat, and thanks for continuing to help us find a path of sanity, you know, through what feels an ocean of insanity.
I think there is a way to sanity. And I think the first step to sanity is the fact that so many people are saying, why are we in such insane times? For a while, I think what happens is the same people think they're insane.
Right.
Because they start to say, something must be wrong with me, that this just seems crazy. But I think we're at the point now where a lot of people are starting to say, this isn't normal. And that's the first step to looking for something better, I think.
Well, tell us, Russell, where do we go if we want to hear more of these questions and answers?
Well, every week we will be here, sometimes doing conversations with folks and sometimes doing questions and answers. And I want to hear from our listeners with whatever questions you have about the Bible, about theology, about ethics, about relationships, about personal situation, whatever it is, send it to questions@russellmoore.com and we will do our best to answer them. And you're listening to The Russell Moore Show. We'd really like you to go and subscribe, send it to a friend, leave a review, and check the show notes to find other resources that might be of interest to you, including how to have a trial membership here at Christianity Today. This is Russell Moore, and this is The Russell Moore Show from Christianity Today.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Executive producers are Eric Petrick, Russell Moore, and Mike Cosbert. Hosted by Russell Moore, produced by Ashley Hales. Associate producers Abby Perry and Azaray Phelps. CT administration provided by Christine Kolb. Social media by Kate Lucky. Director of operations for CT Media is Matt Stevens. Production assistance provided by Core Media. Audio engineer is Kevin Duthu. Coordinator is Beth Grabencourt. Video producer is John Roland. The theme song for The Russell Moore Show is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton.